We've been hearing this for a while now.
We will build a great wall along the southern border. And Mexico will pay for the wall.
Now, if you're American, other than Native American, either you or your ancestors came from someplace else. They were immigrants. They worked hard, built a new life, and their kids and grandkids became American as anyone else. Some in the camp of Americans who now want to pull up the ladder behind them so others can't do what their ancestors did. But then what? People have been moving around the world for as long as there have been people. Borders have been drawn, they've been erased, they've moved and expanded, they've been ignored by Westerners as well as by everyone else. I mean, think about it. In the age of empire, Western powers didn't care about Africans and Asians' rights to sovereignty and self-determination, nor did Americans settling the frontier. If they could conquer, they went in. And now? Now it's the age of nation-states and set borders. And while people are still moving around the world, as they've always done, many of the world's richest countries are feeling defensive. Hence, Brexit and the backlash in Europe against refugees, and Donald Trump's appeal to Americans who don't want immigrants they don't like. So, what's the future of borders in this century? How much will they shape or limit opportunities and identity for those within them? And how much can borders be effectively enforced in an age of climate change and regional inequality without a cost beyond what a society is willing to pay? This is Whose Century Is It? A podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstead. Many of us take borders as a given. We don't think too hard about how they got there or why they're in one place and not another, how battles were fought to settle some borders, lines drawn arbitrarily, almost carelessly, maybe right through communities. There they are now, defining our towns and states, our provinces and nations, sometimes our regional groupings. They include and exclude. They provide a layer of identity and opportunity for some and deny it to others. Some of us, myself included, have lived much of our lives beyond the borders of the place where we were born, the place where we grew up, the city, the state, the nation. Some of us have so many layers to our identities that borders seem kind of beside the point.
I was born in Malaysia. My grandparents had migrated from Sri Lanka and we were Jaffna Tamils. I ended up in Australia by accident, high school onwards, and my parents moved back to Malaysia. I stayed, became a citizen there, and then...
And then, after a stint heading the Department of Political Theory at the University of Utah, Chandran Kukuthas moved to London and became head of the Department of Government at the London School of Economics and a professor in political theory.
My experience is generally one that's, you know, sympathetic to freedom of movement, and it's a very much cosmopolitan kind of outlook.
Chandran's book, The Liberal Archipelago, argues that a society is free to the extent that it is tolerant of overlapping islands of identity, values, and goals. No need for a melting pot. He's now working on a book on immigration and the ebbs and flows of levels of tolerance in accepting new people into a society over time.
If you go back into the history of immigration, let's just take the United States, for example. There have been a succession of major and minor legislative measures to try to control immigration. If you go back to, say, 1882, you have the Chinese Exclusion Act, designed to actually exclude a particular category of people based on their racial type. In the early 20th century, you had an extension of this to try to exclude Asians more generally. At this time, American immigration policy and law was highly racialized, so people were categorized in different ways to indicate who could not come in.
And some people were let in with the understanding that they could not become citizens.
Asians could not become citizens. Europeans were regarded as citizens in waiting, but not others. The Irish were famously excluded from being regarded as possible citizens. I mean, one curiosity is that, you know, in the late 19th and early 20th century, they didn't know what to do about Jews, so they were classified as Asians. Okay? So if you look at immigration policy now, You know, it's not that it's suddenly become horribly racist or horribly anti-cosmopolitan or horribly anti-immigration. There have been waves and waves of different attitudes, different forms of classification. And I mean, people have continued to move because, you know, one of the points I like to remind people of is that, in a sense, life goes on regardless. I mean, you know, people run their lives not according to national regulation. They run their lives according to the aspirations they have, the people they meet, the ambitions they develop. This is what will guide them, not some law that's been made in Washington or in Los Angeles or wherever.
And so, we saw the exodus of refugees last year from places like Syria, Afghanistan, and parts of Africa, to Turkey and Greece, and eventually to Germany and other parts of Europe. Accepting them was a compassionate thing to do. And on a pragmatic level, it also infused aging societies and sluggish economies with energetic young people who could give them a boost, if and when they're allowed to integrate and work. But then came protest and resistance from citizens in some of the countries receiving the refugees. And Chandran says this is part of a longer-term trend he's seen while living in Britain.
As I've lived here for the last 9 years, I've noticed that more and more, not only Britain, but Europe more generally, is closing its borders. It's allowing for freedom of movement within the Schengen area and within, you know, Europe more generally, since Britain isn't a part of Schengen.
Sorry, Schengen, for Americans who don't normally hear about this,
is the area that allows for freedom of movement without border control. So it excludes Britain, even though it's a part of the EU, but it includes Switzerland, it includes Norway. Schengen is the term that's used for the region because it's based on the Schengen Agreement. So what I've found is that more and more Europe is strengthening its external borders. It's got a very sophisticated and, you know, quite harsh system of border controls all around the external borders of Europe, even while the internal borders are open.
What do you think is driving this closing of borders?
That's a good question. I think there are two things that need to be figured out. To what extent it's a push from the general public, and to what extent it's driven by particular elites. Now, I think it's clear that the kind of liberal elite is generally in favor of a certain kind of free movement, but there are certainly very strong and influential elites that are against that kind of freedom of movement because they are interested in preserving a kind of cultural control. There are certainly, you know, lots of, you know, economic factors within these societies that might lead the public to be hostile to immigration. In particular, poor economic conditions or unemployment might be thought to be a factor. But it's hard to know because in most places in Britain, for example, where there are a lot of migrants, the tendency is for people to be more pro-immigration, less hostile to foreigners. The hostility is much more in places where there are very, very few immigrants. Not entirely. I mean, some places, for example, where they see that people coming from overseas are, you know, taking up places in schools or putting pressure on local services and so on, there is hostility. I think it's probably some combination of these things.
Interestingly, you didn't mention fear of terrorism.
I think the fear of terrorism may be a part of it, and I'm sure if you, you know, asked a list of questions and you put that on the list, people would acknowledge it. But the problem here is that immigration control is really a very clumsy tool with which to deal with terrorism. You know, if you think about the major terrorist attacks in Britain, they were all by domestic people, in fact, in some cases citizens. The same is true in the United States. There was no problem getting into the country. And immigration control, you know, as I've suggested in some of my writings, it's not really about controlling movement or entry, because hundreds of thousands and millions of people cross all the time. So if you're going to control terrorism by controlling the right to work, or, you know, by reducing the length of a visa from 6 months to 3 months, you're not going to make any difference. Okay. So to address the problem of terrorism, you need a very different set of tools.
You may or may not agree with that, and the Department of Homeland Security certainly would not. But think about the most recent high-profile terrorist cases in the United States. San Bernardino, Orlando, the homemade bombs in New York and New Jersey in September, and the stabbings in a shopping mall in Minnesota. All were committed by legal U.S. residents, some even by U.S. citizens. And sure, Donald Trump's response has been, easy fix, just exclude all Muslims.
Leave aside the fact that hundreds of times more Americans are killed by guns shot by other Americans who are not Muslim than by Islamist extremists. There's another reason why Trump's proposal is a bad idea. Chandran argues that doing something like that, even advocating to do something like that, erodes what makes America, or any place, a free society.
So this is the kind of view of liberalism that I've tried to defend for a long time, which is to say that if a liberal society is one that values freedom, particularly values freedoms of speech and freedom to, in a sense, to go your own way and live your own life, that has to mean that it will tolerate those who themselves don't really care for liberalism. Now, a liberal society will not be able to tolerate those who try to subvert it, you know, or to act in violent ways and prevent others from living as they see fit. But to the extent that people simply want to withdraw and figure out their own ways of living, a liberal society would tolerate that. And if that's the case, then it has to be the case as a matter of logic that a liberal society tolerates illiberal elements.
You also have, especially post 9/11, people conflating someone who's Muslim with someone who's an Islamist extremist, which obviously is totally unfair and inaccurate. But let's say that there are people who are Islamist advocates who want to see a caliphate, and they're in the United States. What would your argument be then?
It really does depend on what it is that they're doing. You know, if they're simply expressing this wish, well, you know, they have the freedom of speech to do so. But if they're engaging in activities that are going to lead to extremist attacks or that lead to violence, it seems to me it would just be sensible for the authorities to keep an eye on this, you know, to make sure that, you know, nothing is going to come of this. It may be important that they think about whether this is working to radicalize elements of the population, again, with a view to turning them into something more than just, you know, people who are willing to publicly advocate their own, you know, point of view. But I don't think that really requires that you come down and deprive even these people of their freedom, let alone tar every Muslim with the same brush. I mean, there are many extremists in every religion, whether you're talking about Hindus or Buddhists. I mean, you know, almost any religious group can have a political aspect to it.
So who is the we? It seems an important and fundamental question. I mean, it really brings into question everything, you know, the multiple identities we all carry within ourselves, where borders are drawn and why. Sometimes they're drawn right through communities that consider themselves to be a whole. Yeah. Quite often they're drawn right through communities. Do you think that the way in which people define themselves will change in significant ways in this century, where the borders themselves, the nation state, the Westphalian approach, the lines might become more blurred than they were in the 20th century?
So I think the lines are always blurred because there are no natural we's. I mean, every we is something that's constructed to some degree. Now, in some cases, they could be constructed by simply the imposition of a definition by someone else who says, look, you know, I've taken control of this. This is the relevant unit. This is how we will understand it. This is how we will define it. And, you know, over time, it may, in fact, come to have a certain kind of identity because of it. In other cases, there may be some factors that make it more naturally a kind of we. I mean, if you're in Iceland and you're 300,000 people with a single language, very few immigrants, there is going to be a stronger, naturally grounded identity. But in other parts of the world, if you just look at the history of boundaries, you'll see that there are so many different we's. If you go back to Europe, you know, 500 years ago, there were 700 principalities and republics and city-states, as well as empires such as the Holy Roman Empire or big states like Sweden and France and the Kingdom of Lithuania, which covered large parts of what is now, you know, Eastern Europe. It's all changed. I mean, we've forgotten about so many of these kingdoms. So I think everywhere the boundaries change, the sense of identity and community changes. It's not stable. In Britain, for example, there are many people who at Brexit said, we are Europeans. They wanted to remain. But half the population didn't see it that way. In Scotland, a bare majority of the population decided that they wanted to be a part of the United Kingdom. But clearly, you know, 45% of the Scots wanted to be seen primarily as Scottish and independent and not as a part of Britain. But even they are divided because some of them want to be a part of the EU and some of them don't. So I think what all of this means is that the boundaries that shape and identify and distinguish separate identities, separate we's, if you like, are always essentially compromises of some sort. Sometimes they're political compromises, sometimes they're economic, sometimes they're some sort of mixture. Because for all kinds of practical reasons, we have to, you know, organize, you know, politically and socially and culturally to achieve various things. And that brings with it a kind of sense of community and identity and attachment and so on. But I think it would be a mistake to try to say, well, look, this is just the way things are. These are somehow real in a sense that there's some naturalistic basis to it. When things change, the identities and the shapes and the territorial groupings will change. I don't know how, but this is the way it's always been in human history, and I don't see any reason to think that this is somehow different now.
And yet, particularly in a moment of national crisis like 9/11, post-9/11, there is this very strong pressure to accept that your primary identity should be, as in the case of 9/11, American, that you should be foursquare behind the nation state and be patriotic and nationalistic, and everything else should fall well below that in the hierarchy. As a political theorist, but also as an individual who's lived in many places and who has a complex background yourself, how do you view a phenomenon like that and what it does to how people conceive of what their relationships are to each other?
Well, firstly, putting on my analytical hat, I'd say that the reason why you get this phenomenon of this emphasis on patriotism, you know, putting your country first, identifying primarily with this, is because the ruling elites, governments, if you like, have a very, very strong interest in promoting that message. They need to do so for a number of reasons. One is simply to make sure that their legitimacy is acknowledged, because if it's not, then you're going to have a very difficult time ruling. So you need to bring people on board. And all the more important in times of crisis, if you're, you know, in wartime, if, you know, there's some external threat, at that point, you know, you'll try to galvanize the population to support you. And most of the time, the populations are not in favor of war. They don't want their sons going off into battle. They don't want all the things that come with it. So what are you going to do to persuade people that this is what they have to sacrifice? Well, you're not going to be able to do it by offering them money. You're not going to be able to do it by offering them any other sort of tangible goods. So you've got to appeal to a kind of sense of duty, a kind of sense of morality. Well, I think creating this emphasis on something like loyalty to the state is going to be crucial. It's, I think, the case not just if you look at big nation states. It's going to be the case with any group that is going to face some sort of external threat. So I think the first thing I'd say is that, you know, this is what lies behind it. But people will internalize the value, and over time this will become important. And they'll retell the history in a different way. I mean, if you look at the American Revolution, for example, very few people now remember that there was a very big chunk of people then who were loyalists, who did not want to go with the revolutionaries. And they were treated very badly after the revolution, because the newly founded government had to establish its own authority. It had to build a kind of attachment to what they had created. So it is created, but once it's created, it will take on a kind of life of its own. Now, that's my analytical view. What is my own position on this? Well, you know, you've already learned that I've got a pretty cosmopolitan outlook. I've lived in many different countries. This kind of attachment is not something that's important to me. It's not that there aren't attachments that are important for me, but an attachment to a country or a state is not. To that extent, when I get very interested or committed to a cause that's, say, associated with the state, it's really because that's where I happen to live, that's where I can make a difference. It's not that I want to say that you shouldn't take an interest in public affairs, for example. I mean, in Australia, one of the things that I was most interested in was the treatment of refugees. So I would, you know, be willing to engage in activism of one kind or another in order to address this issue. And I would do so particularly because I'm an Australian, I'm an Australian citizen. This is where I live, this is the community I'm in, so this is where it makes more sense for me to do this. But I don't feel, as a result of this, any great wave of patriotic feeling or, you know, sense that this is a superior place or a special loyalty because of an attachment that I have here. To me, the idea of, you know, my country right or wrong is a bad thing. But I think this is not the way, you know, a lot of people think, maybe even most, I don't know. And I think the reason for this, to go back to my analytical point, is that this is the way that states operate. It's the only logical thing for them to do. If they want to maintain themselves and operate as they have to, then they've got to bring the population along, and this is what they will foster.
That's the modern nation state. And then there's the population. And it wasn't so many thousands of years ago that we were tribal, right? That people feel like, okay, you're like me, and therefore you're on my side, and you're not like me, and therefore you're not. And there are ways in which that plays out. Like, for instance, where you grew up in Malaysia, there's the Bumiputra policy, which favors ethnic Malays over Indians or Chinese whose families may have lived in Malaysia for many generations. Here, it's playing out with the Brexit vote. There are many different reasons why people may have voted for Brexit, but one of them certainly that keeps coming up is we're losing our sense of Englishness. And yet, as the world has globalized and as it's become easier for people to move around, inevitably more people have connected with each other and intermarried. And I'm wondering whether you feel like this is kind of a, not exactly a last gasp, but at least a defensive pushback to a kind of an inevitable change that is going to probably just become bigger as we move forward.
I think it may be, but I don't think it's a last gasp.
Yeah.
I think it's, you know, the latest in a continuing series of gasps, because, you know, over the centuries, as people have moved, as boundaries have shifted, there have been two forces at work, really. The forces that want to preserve what's established and traditional and, you know, the agreed norm, and those who want to change things. And those who want to change things are both those within those, you know, societies or groups, and, you know, those outside who either want to come in or want to trade. And I think this is simply something that's a part of the human condition. There will always be a tension between the traditional and the modern, between the young and the old, between the old and the new. And what we're seeing, I think, is in part simply the processes of history. It's got this particular shape right now, but I don't think this is going to be any different in 1,000 years. Now, looking at the issue specifically with respect to the terminology of multiculturalism, for example, I think that is a part of the story, given that there's much more movement and interaction than there once was. The main change is probably the distance that people can move and the speed with which they can move. So it looks like, in a way, it's a much more dynamic and fast-moving set of changes that are taking place. But in another sense, of course, it doesn't really matter if you're the local group and you're welcoming an outsider who is only 10 miles away in a world in which it would take you a day to get 10 miles. They're just as foreign as someone coming from China or from Korea or from, you know, New Zealand. In some ways, they may even be less foreign, because the fact that you've got international communications now and international shared cultural motifs and shared norms of all kinds with international law means that someone from Singapore moving to New York might find New Yorkers see him as much less alien than, say, if they had someone coming from rural Utah, where they're growing up as very traditional Mormons and very, very religious, whereas a Singaporean comes in as a cosmopolitan to a city that's already very cosmopolitan. They all speak English. So I think the multicultural thing needs to be examined a little bit more closely, and it's not just that the world is globalized that makes the difference. I think now it's just much more visible. But I think, again, you know, the same thing has happened that's always happened. The conflict between traditional and modern, old and new, inside and outside, it's just going to continue.
Which does put in perspective the most recent rise of nativist sentiment in parts of Europe and the United States.
And because immigration is one of the variables that has long shaped our world and is already shaping our century, I'm going to keep the focus on immigration, identity, and borders for the next couple of episodes, drawing on reporting I've been doing in England, Ireland, and Germany. Meanwhile, thanks to Chandran Kukuthas, head of the London School of Economics Department of Government, for framing these issues in such interesting and provocative ways. Comments, criticisms, ideas for future episodes? I'd love to hear them. Drop me a line at whocentury@gmail.com. Or you can send me a message on Twitter at Mary Kay Magstad, that's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. You can read the transcript of this interview and explore all our episodes at pri.org/century. We're on iTunes and most other podcast apps, and on SoundCloud and Stitcher. In fact, if you like the podcast, spread the word. Please rate us on iTunes and leave a review. It helps others find the podcast. Whose Century Is It? Is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC World Service and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. Thanks for listening. Join us next time.